You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with Nadine Budbill, whose father was the Vermont author and poet David Budbill. He was the author of 8 books of poems, 8 plays, a novel, a collection of short stories, a picture book for children, and dozens of essays, introductions, speeches, and book reviews. He also served as an occasional commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. His collection of narrative poems, Judevine, was published in 1991. His honors and prizes include an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters from New England College in 2009, a Guggenheim Foundation in Poetry in 1981, a National Endowment for the Arts Playwriting Fellowship in 1991, the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award for Fiction in 1978, and the Vermont Arts Council's Walter Cerf Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts in 2002. David and his wife Lois Eby and their daughter Nadine lived on a remote mountainside in the southwest corner of Vermont's Northeast Kingdom, a place of great beauty and sometimes tough living. At the end of his life, David and his wife moved to the capital city of Montpelier, Vermont. David's website can be found at davidbudbill.com. I spoke to David Budbill on the show 2 different times, and you can find those interviews on the podcast site. Nadine Budbill is her father's literary executor. She is a massage therapist and has worked for many years empowering girls and women through such organizations as Vermont Works for Women, Dirt Divas, and Girls Move Mountains. When I spoke to her, I began by asking her to talk about her father's work, its influence on her, and how his work will live on. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, when I think about it, I feel like my dad and his work are just permeated throughout me and have had such a huge influence on me. I mean, first and foremost, my dad as a person and as a father had such a huge, tremendous influence on me. But his work was always such an extension of himself. There wasn't there was not a distinction really between him and his work. He lived and breathed it, and so much of it, it just sort of was him, and he was it. So it's sort of all one and the same.
Now, did you grow up? I interviewed him twice at their home in the woods up in
Walcott.
Walcott, right? Did you grow up in that home?
I did.
Yeah. So that's the place they lived for, I think he talks about being there for 40 years or something.
45, yeah.
45 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's where they lived until they moved to Montpelier because of his illness and his declining health. So they moved in 2015.
Now, when you were little and your father would be working, you know, was it the kind of thing where he's down on the kitchen table and there's just life happening around him, or would he go up to his study and sort of be like, this is my dedicated time and I'll be down in a little while? And
oh, yeah, he would go upstairs to his room where he wrote, and, it was very much like a job in that he went every morning after breakfast and stayed up there until lunch and then would come down and have lunch with us, and then he'd go back up for a while longer, and then often in the afternoon he would go out into the woods to cut wood or go out to the garden and, you know, do the outside work that needed to happen around the place. But I feel like so much of what I learned about discipline I learned from my dad and my mom, because she had the same schedule where she would come out for breakfast and then go into her studio to paint and then emerge at lunch and then go back. And so they were very, very disciplined about work. You know, people have this image of sort of like the loosey-goosey artist lifestyle. That wasn't them. You know, they worked really hard in their respective studios and then really hard out maintaining the house and the garden and the woods and all the stuff that they did around the place. So, so I think that, you know, and I remember seeing Judevine, one of my dad's most famous plays, at a very young age. And that, you know, because when you're a kid, like, you know, fish in water doesn't know it's wet. Like, it just, I didn't realize that I was sort of in the midst of something incredible. I just was, oh, this is what my dad does. And, yeah. And I mean, I thought the play was great at the time, but it wasn't, I didn't have the perspective to realize. It wasn't until seeing it probably again in my 30s when I realized, oh my gosh, this is really phenomenal. And then, and even honestly, it's been since my dad has died and now I'm taking on the role of his literary executor that I can really see his body of work for what it is and just be so blown away by it.
Right,
because again,
scope.
I was so close to it my whole life that I didn't have the perspective to realize his brilliance.
Yeah.
And how prolific he was as a writer, and so it's sort of bowled me over since
yeah.
he has died, just the sheer magnitude of what he wrote and what he contributed and the content of that work.
Now, it's been almost a year since he died, is that correct?
It will be a year in September.
Yeah, and so what's involved in being someone's literary executor?
This past year, there's just been a lot of things to respond to. I please use the analogy. I feel like I'm playing tennis, like, oh, got to get that ball and then that ball. And, you know, a lot of things coming at me, a lot of permissions requests, you know, to use various pieces of his. And most of those, I don't have the ability to give permission. I have to pass people on to his publisher. But because there's been various events to honor him, and Jus Divine was produced in Montpelier in April, and then the memorial service and various other things, there's just been a lot happening, not to mention that there were two books published posthumously.
Right.
And so particularly with one of them, Broken Wing,
right.
My dad and I worked together to kind of get it pretty much to the finish line before he died. And so mostly I was just working with Dee Dee, the publisher,
yes.
to kind of take it the rest of the way. But his final book of poetry, Tumbling Toward the End, he and I had worked on probably the first and second round of edits together, and then I had to do the rest of the edits myself. So as his literary executor, sort of working on those books, helping to market them, responding to requests and various inquiries from people about his work. And the next phase of the work for me is really thinking more proactively, and because the tennis balls have stopped shooting at me, and thinking, you know, what do I want to do with his body of work and his legacy, and how do I shepherd it and promote it and give it a chance to continue to shine.
Is that something that you would perhaps get in touch with the Vermont Humanities Council or I don't know, I'm just thinking, are there state organizations that would help you preserve the body of work as a Vermont poet?
His papers are all in the Special Collections Library at the University of Vermont.
Okay.
And so there, everything is being collected and organized and housed there, so that it will be there forever,
yeah.
in theory, for people to be able to access. And that's, you know, we're always sending stuff to them to make sure we have a really good archive of all of his work, and not just his writings, but his letters and correspondence with people and, various publicity elements that are important to save. And so
there's
I know they have boxes upon boxes of his stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about the beautiful memorial that came together last month in Barrie. It was just amazing. And I just wondered if you can talk a little bit about the evolution of it and also sort of just like how it achieved this sense of both celebrating his life and work and remembering him, but also kind of presenting him to a public anew. You know, I felt like I was at not just a memorial service, but also a presentation of work, which I really loved.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it was received that way. My mom, Lois Eby, and I did get to have a conversation with my dad before he died about what he wanted in a memorial service, and he didn't have a whole lot of instructions or directions for us other than he wanted something where people came together to sort of celebrate his life and his work.
Right.
So he, you know, we had a very vague direction from him. And we took that and sort of, right, wanted to figure out how to bring together all of these different elements of him as a person, as a father, as a friend, as a mentor, and then him as a writer and all of his creative work.
Yeah.
And also wanted it to be joyful and celebratory and funny at times.
Yeah.
And of course also profound and sad and intense. And we wanted there to be sort of a spiritual element to it that wasn't connected to any particular doctrine. And that, you know, I think that was so much my dad and my mom and myself, I suppose, that living life with this a real profound sense of spirituality, but not being engaged in any one tradition.
Right.
And I feel like we were able to capture that in this
Absolutely.
In the memorial, that there was this real sort of sacred feeling to the event, even though it wasn't in the Christian or the Buddhist or the whatever tradition.
Yeah, I loved that you kind of began and ended with William Parker doing the, I don't remember what the bowl is called.
The Tibetan bowls.
Right. And
King bowls.
He, you know, it just, the whole building, it was at the Barry Opera House, and everybody just went silent and listened to this sort of otherworldly sound coming out of this bowl. That I thought really set a very spiritual tone right away.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, your father's not having a lot of instruction around his memorial. Do you think that that's because he wanted to leave it up to you, or do you think that that's because, due to the disease, he really wasn't able to communicate very well by that point?
I think both.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly he wasn't able to communicate very well by that point, but I don't think he would have. It's not something he would have prescribed anyway.
It wasn't
his
style.
If we talked about it a decade ago, he wouldn't have said, I want this and this and this. No.
Yeah.
No, he would have recognized it was sort of our, at that point, once he was gone, our job to sort of figure out the pieces and put it all together ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the breadth of his work. So he wrote poetry, he wrote prose, he wrote plays like Judevine. That was also turned into an opera. Which I think he certainly had input on. And I'm just wondering, are there plans for any new productions of his work, or any other sort of events or celebratory, you know, retrospectives, anything like that?
The one thing that's in the works is another production of the opera that you mentioned, which is called A Fleeting Animal,
right.
An opera from Judevine. And the composer, Eric Nielsen, had you know, seen Judevine many times and had been commissioned to write a Vermont story as an opera, and he knew immediately that he wanted it to be a story from Judevine, and contacted my dad, and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. And so they worked together. My dad wrote the libretto. Eric composed the music, and I don't know if you saw the opera.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's really incredible. So there's plans, I think, for 2018 to try to tour it around New England.
Okay.
So that'll be great. And otherwise, there isn't anything that we know of. Things do pop up.
Now, was Eric was part of the memorial, correct?
He was. He had quite a few hands in it.
Yes.
There was the world premiere of a song cycle that he had composed based on my dad's poem.
Which was beautiful.
Autumn of the Poet. Yeah.
And the woman who sang it, there was an opera singer who sang.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep, and then he there was one piece from the opera in that memorial celebration, the 90 Days of Summer, which is a blues, sort of a rock and blues tune.
Yes, it's funny. My husband and I have been turning and saying that to each other ever since we went to that. Like, 90 days, 90 days,
right.
That's all we've got.
Got it, right? right, it gives some urgency to it, right? Yeah, and then Eric also composed, there was a song at the end that everyone stood and sang together, and Eric composed that song. So he was a very important collaborator for my dad, with William Parker.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Broken Wing, this beautiful new book that was published either, was it this year or last year? I guess last year.
It was December 2016.
Yeah, and it's a young adult book, but I really feel like anybody can read and enjoy book. So are you aware of what the inspiration was or how he came to the idea for Broken Wing?
Broken Wing was the inspiration. There was a Broken Wing.
Ah.
Yeah. There was exactly the main bird character of that book was a real bird, a rusty blackbird with a broken wing. That my dad noticed and sort of befriended and tried to take care of, who was stuck in because of its broken wing, was stuck in Vermont when the rest of its comrades had flown south.
Okay.
So I think, that was the genesis of the story and the main inspiration. And then, as my dad often did, he was pulling other pieces of inspiration from lots of different areas and parts of his life and pieces of his imagination I think Broken Wing, the book, is sort of the most, I think it's phenomenal, and it just brings together in this really profound way comprehensively every piece of who my dad was.
Yes.
And his interests and his passions.
Yes.
And then kind of weaves it all together in one story, which is just, and the fact that it didn't come out until after he died, it just feels like this incredible gift that he left.
Yeah, it's amazing.
For us. That was like everything about that book is him. It's
yes.
Like every, down to like the DNA level of that book is just interwoven with who my dad was.
Yeah, it's a Vermont story. It's a story of nature. It's a story that has music. It has Chinese influence. It's a story of race, in a very subtle and beautiful way. It's just an extraordinary. So it must have been. I know that it came out of a very painful place, but it must have been sort of a gift that you were able to work with him in editing it and bringing it to fruition in the end.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, certainly, it's not what I would have chosen. I would have chosen that he was still here and going on book tour with his new books.
Yeah.
But given the fact that that is not what was dealt to us in the cards, it was and still is a really beautiful gift to be able to work on these books and sort of shepherd them along and like try my very hardest to do my best by my dad.
No, yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and this is an interview with Nadine Budbill, whose father was Vermont author, poet, David Budbill. And in the next segment of this interview, you're going to hear again from Dee Dee Cummings, because Dee Dee Cummings, who was the interview in the first half of the show today, she's the publisher of his novel, Broken Wing. And so I asked Dee Dee a few questions about David and his work. We're going to listen to that for a little while, and then we'll return to Nadine's and my conversation. We are streaming on 99.3 WBTV.org. So Green Writers Press published David Budbill's novel, Broken Wing. And I wanted to know how this book first came to Green Writers Press and just a little bit about your interactions with David as this was being produced.
I've long admired David Budbill as a poet. And even, when I moved back to Vermont in the mid 80s after working at Little Brown. And, you know, I loved Bud Bill's work. So I was really excited when, out of the blue, one afternoon in my home office, I got an email from him. And he said, he said, I'd like to talk with you about publishing a few of my books, not one. And he said, I've got a few projects to talk with you about. And I almost, you know, fell off my chair. I was so excited. And he had read about me in 7 days. Yeah. I have to give them a lot of credit. They've been really supportive.
Well, and your mission of environmentalism is so in keeping with his philosophy throughout his life.
Oh, totally. And we completely clicked. We talked on the phone for, I just tell Nadine and his wife, Lois Eby, she's an artist. I've gotten really close to them and how thrilling it was for me to be able to work with David and just to talk with him and plan the three books that I'm going to be working with. And we shared this passion for really trying to bring a message of environmental conservation and activism to young people. And, you know, I love the teachings of the Dalai Lama. And he also says, you know, teachers are really the future. And children are, but the teachers enable the children to you know, move forward, especially in the face of, you know, the climate crisis that, you know, is really potentially and moving in the direction of no return. And that's, you know, a hard thing for people to even think about, right? You know, it's hard enough to think about one's mortality. But then, you know, to be a young person now with our current administration in Washington, it's just tough. And so my philosophy is to always, you know, try to bring hope through what we do and the words and images we publish. And David really responded to that, you know, the environmental, you know, message and the ethos of our press really did align with his work. So we connected and we planned out three books, so beginning with this novel. Now, he wanted this to be a young adult novel. Mm-hmm. The term young adult, like books like, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or Catch and Run, you know, I don't really think of them as young adults. I mean, yes, the protagonist is a teenager, you know, so that would then kind of qualify it as a young adult. In this case, the book is really, the protagonist is an old man.
Yeah.
And so technically it's not young adult, but he wanted it, you know, because it's told in the tradition of the folk tale.
Yes.
And, you know, it's an allegory and it's brilliantly done. Yeah. I read this book in one sitting. It's like a long poem. It's a love letter to the, it's a love letter to the world
from an
esteemed poet. And I brought in one of my freelance editors. You know, she has her own business and she's terrific. Her name is Catherine Likes. And I said, Catherine, I've got a book. You know, it doesn't need much. It's more in that, you know, everyone needs a copy editor. And, you know, we use Chicago Manual of Style. And Catherine came on and she flipped over the book.
Yeah.
She thought it was amazing.
It is amazing.
So, and she and David and I went back and forth and we made some changes and, you know, worked back and forth. And then, you know, I don't know, you know, if he knew he had a terminal disease at that point. I think he was still really hopeful that he could beat this degenerative brain condition that he had that was, you know, didn't have a cure.
Right.
The symptoms are like Parkinson's disease, right? And
he
was so brave and focused. And I'm getting emotional now, but just thinking about what, you know, how excited he was about having this book come out into the world. He knew. You know, he's in his last book, very elegiac, just came out a couple of months ago, his last book of poetry from his poetry publisher is Copper Canyon Press,
right.
A press I really, really admire. And so, you know, he had these books coming out posthumously, and he knew that they would come out, and he also... I think he took great comfort in that. And right at the end of his life, I found a local artist. We try to bring in artists who are, you know, from Vermont or from right. the region or from, you know, the country. And we give the artists a lot of credit here at Green Writers, whether they're a photographer or a painter or a children's book illustrator. And so Donald Sass is a neighbor of mine, and he's pretty impressive. I mean, he's had a big career as a children's illustrator, but he's a fine artist and a painter himself. And, you know, I asked him if he could do some illustrations for the story, because David had really specific things he wanted drawn in the book. And I gave Donald the list and introduced him by email to David. And Donald really delivered and made sketches that were very, very finished. And I showed all of them to David, and he approved every single one of them.
He was
overjoyed.
I love the artwork in the book. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And I'm so glad that you published it and that it exists now. It's funny, just in talking to you, it seems to me like you're sort of a storyteller too. Are you a writer?
Oh, not really. I used to write poetry. I used to actually write a lot of spoken word and perform spoken word. And I lived in New York, and my dad and I actually did some, he called it father and daughter together, some performances together, in New York and in Vermont. But that was almost 20 years ago.
Did you do first night stuff together?
We did.
Okay.
And I just sort of lost touch with that part of myself. I don't know. I do love to write. Like, whenever I have a chance to write something for some occasion, I really enjoy it. But I've not been writing as any sort of practice for quite a long time.
But you have a lot of other work that you do. I thought we could talk a little bit about that. You were involved originally in, I'm wishing I could, is it Dirt Divas?
It is, yes.
Yeah. You were one of the founders of that. What was the first name of the organization?
Well, so Dirt Divas was the name of the program that, my old friend Jess Graham and I started in 2001, which was a girls' mountain bike program.
Okay.
And but then I started a nonprofit to kind of be the home for Dirt Divas and other adventure-based programs for adolescent girls, which was called Girls Move Mountains.
Okay, that's the one I knew of.
And then that organization and the program sort of got subsumed by Vermont Works for Women.
Yes.
And then I ended up working there for years, and I've actually now just sort of officially said my goodbyes to that organization and to that work after about 20 years of doing it. I am no longer.
Okay.
Dirt Divas, the program, still exists and is thriving, and lots of girls go through it every summer.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
And sort of build confidence and bolster their strength and whatnot through mountain biking and other types of outdoor adventure. So
that's great.
Yeah.
And so do you have a new enterprise, or what are you doing these days?
I am. I'm working towards developing a private practice as a massage therapist.
Oh, okay.
So I'm planning to specialize in fertility work and prenatal, postpartum massage, infant massage, sort of wraparound body work and emotional support for that whole sort of journey for women.
Wonderful. Now, are you in, where do you work out of?
Montpelier.
Okay. That sounds great. That sounds like a nice next step after working with girls. Let's work with their mothers and babies.
Yeah, work with women and a different transition and transformation in life from, you know, adolescence is such a sort of, can be intense and challenging, but also really wonderful transition. And I think the same is true about pregnancy and birth and becoming a mother. It's just sort of time after 20 years and working with not-for-profit organizations, time to do something a little bit different.
Yeah. Okay, great. Now, I wanted to ask about your mom, Lois Eby. Does she have a studio in her home now in Montpelier?
She does. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how's her work going? Is she working?
She is sort of getting back to painting.
Yeah.
You know, my dad's illness was such that he required a lot of care.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very difficult time for our family, a big move from their house of 45 years and then managing his care and his illness. And so she really kind of had a real hiatus from painting, but she's finding her way back now and is having a show at the Lost Nation Theater Gallery in September. So that's great to kind of get her back in the saddle.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Is she, now I know she does a lot of pen and ink, and then some of it's, I don't know what her media is. Is it, does she use watercolor?
Pen and ink and acrylic mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. And her artwork is abstract and colorful and vibrant
and beautiful. I know.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of her work is very Asian influenced as well. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And jazz influenced also.
Okay. Okay.
She and my dad shared that love of jazz and music and, I think particularly avant-garde jazz.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then now David had a granddaughter. You have a daughter. May I ask her name?
Sure, Riley.
Riley.
Her full name is Riley Wolf Budbill Rothline.
Wow, that's a great name.
Wolf was my dad's mother's maiden name, so my grandmother's maiden name was Wolf. And so my dad's full name actually was David Wolf Budbill, and my name is Nadine Wolf Budbill.
Okay.
So we wanted to pass down the Wolf, and then, of course, she has the name Budbill, and then also my partner's last name, too, Rothline.
Rothline. Okay. And now how old is Riley?
She's 3.5 today.
Oh, wow.
Today's her half birthday, yeah. Yeah, so she and my dad got, about 2.5 years or so together on the planet, which was one of the hardest things for me is how little time they got together, because my dad would have just been the most incredible grandfather and always wanted to be a grandfather.
Yeah.
He hounded me about having grandkids. And then I think he sort of given up on it. And finally, 37, I had one, but he was so excited to have a grandchild, and he's just, my dad was such a goofball and so playful and silly and so great with kids.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like the gravitational force that kids always made their way to. So it was very sad to not only have them sort of cross paths for such a short amount of time, but during that time, my dad was really not well. So
yeah.
Wasn't able to have the type of relationship that he would have had otherwise. So,
yeah.
But I am also, on the flip side, grateful that they did at least get to meet and he got to know that she is here.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, the last time I saw your dad was at the Vermont Book Award event in 2015, and I sat next to him. He was already, I think, having a really hard time expressing himself, but he did talk a little bit about his granddaughter, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Funny. Yeah, he absolutely loved her. So, and he dedicated Broken Wing to Riley.
Oh, okay.
So that's really sweet.
Yeah. That's where I've seen, I know I had seen that lineup of names, but I didn't know where I'd seen it recently. Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. So now that you've just mentioned Broken Wing again, there's this beautiful quote. There's this beautiful moment in the book. This philosophy that's espoused. And I just thought it was a really nice line. And I thought we could talk about it as far as how he looked at the world. And it's this: the more closely you watch, the more you see. And the more you see, the more you begin to understand. And the more you understand, the deeper and stronger your feelings become for that which you are watching and seeing and coming to understand. And, he was such a contemplative man, and he was just somebody who was so immersed in his environment, and I think probably spent a lot of time watching and learning about his environment. So I just thought we could talk about that underlying message within the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was, as I was saying before, I have so much of Broken Wing just captures so much of my dad.
Yes.
And that element of watching and observing and looking closely and listening closely was so much what he lived by. You know,
yes.
He didn't just write it. He lived by it. And also the feeling, you know, he was such, had such intense emotions and cried freely and also, like I was saying, loved to be silly and goofy and laugh and play. And he just was full on life from the, you know, I think I said this at that memorial celebration, that he did both joy and suffering with this intensity and integrity that I've never really experienced in anyone else.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, what he's talking about in Broken Wing and in that quote and a lot of his work is the more you listen and look and really come to know and understand, the deeper you feel. And,
yeah.
And that's it. Like, that's sort of the nugget of being alive.
Yeah.
So many people, friends of mine, family friends, other people who, you know, from other states who've written emails in the wake of his death have talked about how their people are kind of experiencing this massive, like, first maybe like crisis, but then moving towards greater alignment with themselves and how they really truly want to live and be who they are. And as a result of his death, like, I think it's really galvanized a lot of people to try to live the life they want to live and stop doing all these things that they don't really have to do, or figure out how to get out of that job that's just suffocating them. And
right. Be less passive and step into life.
Yeah, and really, you know, because he really did, he really found a way to live life on his own terms and do what he wanted to do and be himself. And I think, like, that's such an inspiration for so many people. And it's hard for a lot of people to be able to do that. But he's sort of, especially now, like, you know, something about losing him is sort of that kick in the butt to really try to get it together and be more in alignment with, like, our own truths and who we are.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes it takes a shock to the system to kind of, like, make us wake up and you know, take steps we always think of taking, but, you know.
Right, but we don't really get it together to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was very political as well. I think it's probably just as well that he didn't have to see what was about to come. So.
Yeah, I know. I think it's quite ironic that he died in September, just 6 weeks before the election.
Yeah.
He said, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, and I know a lot of people are really missing his voice.
Absolutely.
And what he would have said and written in response to the current political state of affairs in the world.
Yeah, he was a very galvanizing activist.
And
not just in the work that he published, but also in, you know, he kind of had a wonderful website where he would do a lot of blogging and reaching out. I do want to just mention that Green Writers Press was sort of the perfect press for him to find. You know, their motto is giving voice to writers and artists who will make the world a better place. And my goodness, if that's not who David Budbill was,
right.
I just don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and I know that he had been wanting and trying to find a publisher for Broken Wing for quite some time before he found Dee Dee, who said, we'll do it.
So,
we're grateful to her, for sure.
So what are you reading these days?
Right now I'm actually reading The Book of Joy, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
I've heard about it, but it's pretty phenomenal.
That's the perfect book. You know, your dad would have loved that book.
Yeah.
That's great. And is there anything else that you would like to say that we haven't talked about? Anything else that you would mention about him?
I mean, I think the thing that I always like to say about my dad, two things that come to mind. One is that he was so committed, as you were saying, you know, to activism, but, you know, really to social justice issues, particularly around race and class.
Yes.
And found ways to weave those into his writing, especially in, as you were mentioning, you know, he had this thing called the Judevine Mountain Emolite that he would send out, and into Broken Wing, into the themes of race are really prominent in the opera. You know, that I think, especially with some of his newer, you know, in the past 20 years, his poetry, the sort of ancient Chinese influenced poetry, mm-hmm. It's easy sometimes for people to overlook that piece of who he was mm-hmm. as a person and as a writer, and maybe like easier to do that because it's more comfortable to kind of read his Zen-inspired nature poetry,
right?
Particularly for white people in Vermont or wherever. But I'm just always sort of, you know, knocking at his door saying yes, and he was fiercely committed to issues of race and inequality and class, and that you can't just take one piece of David Budbill. You got to take the whole package. And there was a lot about my dad that, you know, liked to make people uncomfortable by bringing up tough subjects and shining light into dark places.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I just would say is that, you know, because people don't know this about him so much, that he was just the most incredible father that anyone could ever ask for, and was, you know, since I got to be an adult, one of my very best friends, mm-hmm. and just was, we were so, so close, and he was so committed and would do anything for me. So I just feel so blessed to have had him as a dad.
Yeah. Well, Nadine, I want to thank you for talking to me today about your dad and his work, and this beautiful book. I'll just mention again, Broken Wing by David Budbill, published by Green Writers Press. And I'm so glad that you are a person who can keep his memory alive for readers and lovers of literature, and that we had this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're listening to WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Nadine Budbill about the life and work of her father, David Budbill. And we also had a little conversation in the middle there with Dee Dee Cummings, publisher of his book, Broken Wing, wonderful novel. You can also find two interviews with David Budbill on my podcast site, because I spoke to him twice about his poetry collections and his body of work. You can learn more about David's life and work at davidbudbill.com. I want to just remind you that if you like the show, it's really helpful to us if you rate us in iTunes, like us on Facebook, and maybe tweet about what you've heard. It gets the word out to other people. Thanks so much. The views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WBTV LP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Stream the show live each week at 99.3WBTV.org every Monday at 3. And when we are broadcasting, it will be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. I really encourage listeners to get in touch, to suggest guests if you have authors or poets or playwrights, agents, editors, journalists that you think would be interesting interviews, get in touch and let me know, and I'll try to get an interview set up. If you have comments about the show, or if you have news about book-related events in the state of Vermont, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, tell all your friends. That's how the word gets out and people get to listen. Next week, my guest is the author Dean Koontz, whose new suspense series features FBI agent gone rogue Jane Hawk. So we will discuss The Silent Corner, first book in that series. Dean Koontz has written something like 80 books, which is extraordinary. I can't wait to talk to him and find out how he does it. Okay, that's it for this week. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. Have a great week.